series on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater in Portland. This month features local soul artist Ronnie Wright with new vocal diva Tamara Stevens and surprise guests from the Bespeak Project. The event will also have guest DJs, door prizes, and more. Again, that's the Soul City Supper Club concert series with Ronnie Wright and Tamara Stevens on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stay up late with Lanita Duke and Grassroot News on Wednesday, June 22nd from 10 p.m. until midnight as we celebrate the music of Roberta Flack, as well as agitating for social change. Remember, stay up late with me Wednesday, June 22nd, 10 p.m. until midnight on KBOO.
This is Sage in Studio on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Alan Montesilio, in for Dime Roberts. Today we're going to play interviews with two different Asian American performers. These conversations originally aired in January on Pacific Underground, the Asian and Pacific Islander radio show right here on KBOO. First, we'll hear producer Pamela Santos talking with Christina Wong. Christina is a theater performer, comedian, writer, and activist. She's known for her writing and her solo performances, like Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the Wong Street Journal.
KBOO!
KBOO! We can keep saying it.
KBOO! That's the new by Felicia.
We're going to listen to a sample of the Wong Street Journal.
Okay.
I'm Asian. And to my parents' grave disappointment, I am not a Wall Street trader nor captain of industry. I am a performance artist who fights for the marginalized. And here is where I do my best work, the armchair. And this is what I use to take them all down, the iPad.
Christina. You cannot have an existential crisis right now. Existential crises are for those women who read, eat, pray, love. I'll go to hashtag Africa.
I bless the rains down in Africa.
The dark continent. Brought to you by white people. You know, here we call you Mzungu. That is Swahili for white person.
White privilege.
White privilege!
I rock the first iPhone. It's like a spaceship here, but a joke back at home. It's like I'm the Asian Oprah. Through African eyes, I'm the big white Oprah.
A lot of, I want to say, I'm going to call it your recent artwork. Your recent, you're a theater artist.
My new show?
Yes.
The Wong Street Journal.
So the Wong Street Journal, but also I almost feel like I've been seeing it unfold on Facebook.
Yeah.
As you went through your process.
Yeah, I'm trying to write the show.
Yeah, so There's this kind of social media aspect to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of that particular Asian American Civil War was also, you know, it had a lot to do with activism. It had a lot to do with intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And I think the takeaway that I had from it is something that actually came from probably themes you dealt with in your show, which is, you know, what are we actually accomplishing here?
Yeah. Well, can I set a backdrop?
Yes,
describing something that nobody else has seen. So the Wong Street Journal, is my fifth solo show. I had been touring quite a few. I've never toured the Pacific Northwest. So if no one here has heard of me, that's why. Because I'm coming in the fall with the Wong Street Journal. I don't have a date yet, but Boom Arts is presenting me. And I had toured a show called Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That is a long-running show that I still tour in excerpts about the high rates of depression and suicide among Asian American women. I started touring that in 2006. I still tour it. So you imagine 9 years living with a show about that topic, even a very funny show, which this was, is pretty killer. And it was killing my psyche. And I didn't know who I was anymore. I was becoming the character of Christina Wong that I portray in the show, if that makes any sense. I did two follow-up shows, one called Going Green the Wong Way, another called Cat Lady. Both of them, I was performing versions of myself. And I was like, I hate this. I hate feeling like a human VCR. I am jaded by theater. And I was like, I'm going to Africa. I don't know why. I've never gone. I'm just going to do a show. I've never even been to China, which is in theory my motherland, right? My grandparents immigrated from China. I've never been. And admittedly, that was a very entitled eat, pray, love moment that I had, which we are not allowed to have as people of color, right? As strong, radical people of color, we're not allowed to have eat, pray, love moments, right? Because that is reserved for people who read that book and for white women who are panicking about their lives, right? But no, I was panicking about my life and I needed to find myself in that sort of setting. And so I signed on to volunteer with a microloan organization that gave microloans to women affected by the Ugandan Civil War, which ended in 2006. And I ended up making a rap album while I was there with local rappers. I also found myself really not sure how to exist, because in America, I do a lot of shows about being marginalized. In that moment, I was getting in a lot of fights with people on Twitter about essays I had written, and people were accusing me of stuff. And it was just like, and I would fight right back. And it was like sort of this thrill, because the more I fought on Twitter, the more followers I gained. And I show up there where I am a Mzungu. I am, that's the word they use for white people. I am of privilege. I have, even in my poorest tier, I have so much over there. And I did not know how to best wield that privilege, because there was no invisible oppressor in the room to blame the way you can on Twitter. You can't blame structural racism. Like, you can, but I don't see what the point is, because you're face to face, you know, with people who are on the bottom end of your privilege. And I had to figure out how to best exist and make a rap album and work with people and wield my privilege. And that's the story of the Wong Street Journal. And it's something I'm still dealing with now. It's like, yeah, I could keep yelling at people in the room who aren't there and say, this, because it is the result of inequity and racism, structural racism, that Africa has gotten the bottom end of it. But also what I witnessed there is that the narrative we've painted in the West of Africa is of like, save the children, and oh God, these people are so helpless, and everyone has AIDS, and they're in war. And that is not necessarily what, that is not, you know, yes, there's AIDS, yes, there's war, but there's chaos, but there is also people working very hard. There are people who are self-determining their own futures. There are people starting their own businesses. And that narrative is completely erased because of this narrative that we are the only ones who can save them, white saviorhood, that if we show up there, we can fix it, which is not the case.
So when I was living in New York, I volunteered for UN for Women.
Yeah.
And I did kind of experience this this crisis of conscience that we weren't doing things to just, let's say, focus on people in the South Bronx or women, primarily African-American women, are at high risk for HIV.
Yeah.
So we're not even doing any of that. It's just like, oh my gosh, Africa. Oh my gosh,
yeah.
Philippines. Oh my gosh, let's do all of these things to help these programs here.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how to navigate that.
I think it's tricky, right? Because we definitely have so many problems at home, and we keep talking about, I don't know, we keep talking about, but the narrative is constantly like, oh, save those poor countries. Mm-hmm. We need to save ourselves. It's not to say we don't need it. We can't, we should not be helping other people, but we got to check our own stuff. Like how, like there's 43 million people living in this country under the poverty line, right? Is that acceptable? And I think it was Trump. It was probably Trump. He was criticizing how maybe it was Carson. They're all the same at this point. they were during the GOP debate. They were criticizing how North Korea is building a military and not feeding the hungry. And I'm like, in ways, you could say we're doing the same thing. We're building a military, but not putting money into schools or to getting people out of poverty. It's a different extreme. But
we're actually doing that. We are literally doing that on a actually larger scale. We have like the largest defense budget in the world.
Yeah.
And our education levels are.
I taught a class at CalArts. I was an adjunct. I did not get paid a lot of money, as glamorous as it sounds. I mean, I was actually being paid kind of high for an adjunct, and it was an insane amount of work. And I can't. I just think my hat's off to teachers like who are working 40 hours a week and they're running, you know, teaching how many classes and then they have a grading load. And I was just like, how are we not paying teachers millions of dollars? Like this is insane work to prep a future. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that motivation's not there, how are you going to, you know?
And especially when you're face to face with the future, you're basically looking at, well, I would even put it, you're looking at two faces of the future. You're looking at whatever these kids are potentially going to be, and then what, depending on your influence on them, this. Do you feel like your art is your kind of way to do some of that social change work?
I don't know how I became political in the work. I just find, especially with theater, when you work on something so long, it needs to be about something. In theater, I really craft my shows. Like a lot of people will know me from the essays I've written, what I call clickbait essays, like 9 whack things white guys say to deny their Asian fetish. Like they think that that's the start and end of all I do. I do a lot of things that, like, obviously Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was a pretty intense procedure to create. And I just feel like things, if you're going to spend so long in something, they have to be about something bigger than yourself, and all the ways life intersects. I spend years working on shows and researching it, and I just feel like you, like me in front of an audience, that is a political act, right? Mm-hmm. I am a marginalized person they haven't seen before, and that's a big deal. Like I'm going to take up space and time, and I'm right here.
That was Pacific Underground producer Pamela Santos speaking with performer, writer, and comedian Christina Wong. If you're just joining us, this is Stage and Studio on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Alan Montecilio, in for Dime Roberts. On today's show, we've been playing interviews with Asian American performers. These conversations originally aired on Pacific Underground, the Asian and Pacific Islander show right here on KBOO. On the second part of today's show, we'll hear from Filipino-American writer and poet Reggie Cabico. Reggie is an award-winning slam poet and a former Noriegan Poets Grand Slam champion. He was also the first queer and Asian poet to take top prizes in national poetry slam competitions. He talks again with Pamela Santos about being a poet, laughing at his pain, and teaching poetry in schools.
Nina, look at the sky. April clouds hang a fat, sappy syrup on my saddest day. Played you Monday night. My day unbearable as a wool coach in April. Came back to find my bed empty as a tire swing in winter. Nina, in my saddest hour you have crooned me over a cruel block of loneliness when unrequited love is an Italian bartender who flirts with you from the torso and offers you more lies than a tiramisu. Yes, Nina. Monday night, I was so terribly sad, sadder than a parlor of long veils, carrying groceries up too many flights of stairs. and the sound of your voice, so full and broad-shouldered, made the day with all its drama into bangles and diamonds. Nina, you made me a culinary priestess. You placed a bojangling spell on me, singing above the sizzling oil as I pranced like a tiger among the tambourines and tin cans. The raindrops applauded, and the single wine glass wept because I found my inner Nina. Nina, Nubian Mona Lisa, woman painted with Egyptian mascara. You use silence the way a woman's figure made Jesus bend at the knees. Bend, ache, break to the will of your beautifully blessed contralto, crackling bittersweet as you held a phrase long enough for green finches to fly out the winter gloom. Nina, the storyteller. Nina, a river lonely as hell. Nina, tossed like an ark full of sparrows. You can honky-tonk the bones off Kali and steal the lightning from her toes. Listen, Nina, I think it's going to rain again. Human kindness is overflowing, flowing harder, even in the cruelest times. Well, first of all, I never wanted to be a spoken word poet. I thought I would be in Miss Saigon, but Leah Salonga took my part. So I was just tired of never being Asian enough in the early 90s, which, you know, we've evolved, or at least, you know, but there's still a lot of work to do. But, you know, I was never Asian enough into what casting people wanted me to be. I got fired from shows, and I'm like, until I actually wrote and I actually performed what it is that I wrote, I was able to just reclaim my own identity and to have my own artistic power. I mean, nobody's going to tell me, oh, you can't be on stage. And if that's the case, I will make my own stage. I will be in coffee houses. I'll perform in bars. I'll perform in schools. And so that's really what spoken word is for me. There's a part of me that wanted to be a preacher priest because I wanted to be on the pulpit and like give sermons. So I feel like being a spoken word poet is sort of like my spiritual spell on you all, where I get to be queer and super Filipino and super funky. So without the rise of spoken word at the Eurekan Poets Cafe in 1993, I don't think, who knows, I might be a lawyer or a massage therapist. So yeah, but that is the power of the word. And I wrote because nobody wanted to hear a Filipino-American experience in the 70s in Clinton, Maryland, where it was 50% redneck and 50% African-American. Where do I go? What do I do? You know? And so I feel like I suppressed my whole identity during high school and just in middle school and elementary school. You suppress your identity, and at some point you're just going to have to explode.
I think there was such a huge jump or a leap for me going from, I want to call them almost like dusty poems, like, oh, here are the odes of Shakespeare, here are the Bard and John Donne and this and this and this. Yeah. And there wasn't... definitely in schools, I really don't think they do too much in letting people, probably other than maybe Maya Angelou, they don't get into contemporary poets at all.
They don't. I think things are changing. I think this country is afraid of poetry. People under, and I teach at Bellevue Hospital, so people know art therapy and they know music therapy, but poetry, like, what are you doing with poetry? It's so weird, it's scary, because it's not like we get like poetry, you know, on radio stations. It's not like we have that on our top 40. It's not used that way. So I think that the way that schools teach it, I totally didn't like it. Like, why am I reading Emily Dickinson? Like, why? Like, you know, you know, has she auditioned, you know, for, you know, like, what has she done? So it's sort of like people don't understand poetry. But I think it's changing now. And I think that we are creating a culture in schools where poetry is going to be relevant to students' lives. And for me, poetry for high school students, it's where they can be rebellious and where they can actually be passionate and they can be truthful. So a lot of my work is also teaching youth as well. And that has been, I never thought I'd be doing this. I never, ever thought that I would be an educator. Never thought that I would be, you know, writing poetry. It was just not, I just thought I would just be this actor doing like Shakespeare plays. What I've been thinking now is, and it's a term now, is erasure, and how our work, our bodies, our identity is erased. And you see this in casting when Scarlett Johansson plays an Asian character, you know, and you're seeing the whitewashing. And I'm also seeing it as an educator when I go to schools and fifth graders, they are not focused on writing. The focus is reading and math, and they don't have any kind of writing focus. I'm thinking, wow, these are students of color who are not taught to write, which means that I don't exist. I don't put a mark on the wall. So I'm seeing this whole thing of erasure now. It's in my consciousness, and I think that's the next phase of what I want to talk about, and erasure in my life as a Filipino in D.C. I mean, but I think it can be funny. I think erasure can be funny. And I've always been about the humor. I think we have to laugh. Like, the only way you can be funny is if you really accept it. Then you can be funny. I think that's why it's hard to be funny, because you have to accept the pain. And so now I've, like, it's not that I've accepted the pain. It's more like I've sort of, it's been normalized. And now I'm thinking of erasure. And in my whole 20 years, erasure moments, like small moments of erasure. Like when an usher says, "Are you Hawaiian?" And I'm like, "No, I'm Filipino." And she goes, "Well, in our theater company, we did Beauty and the Beast. And our Belle, she was Chinese." And like, okay. All right. So why? Like, so, okay, good. I'm glad you have a Chinese Belle.
Yeah.
How? And I think we could do it in a comedic way. And I think that poetry is so serious sometimes. But I think there's nothing wrong with being funny. There's nothing wrong with being entertaining. And so humor, I think, is underlooked.
Well, humor is its own kind of therapy.
And Filipinos are funny. Filipinos are OA. We're overacting, but it's also from the OA, there is this humor. And I think that's part of who I am. My Filipino humor is a big part of my identity. So to be funny, I think, it's key, because Filipinos have been through the worst. And so,
and keep on, right?
And we laugh.
I'm sorry, but I have to even
cackle,
say,
right?
There's like, for all of the things that different Filipinos go through, it's almost like, I think if people didn't know what Filipinos were like, that would almost feel like the humor that people have after the super typhoon, things that, you know, people go through. But what are you going to do? You know, I think I've noticed, especially with pretty much whether they're born in the Philippines or they came from, because they're also still absorbing that from their own, like, families and from earlier generations, the humor gets passed down.
Right.
And it's also something to either, sometimes it's a mask, sometimes it covers the hurt, sometimes it's a way to sweep the hurt, and then sometimes it's just a way to show probably that you're hurt, but you're going to laugh at the same time.
Yep. It's
really hard that I think people, I get told all the time about, oh, you're so funny, oh, this, or whatever could be, I think, maybe comparisons of what they wanted to box me in with maybe East Asian women and stereotypes of East Asian yeah. women.
I'm like, screw that.
I guess maybe the major themes that I've gotten from not even just like your old poems, but especially your new work, you have in a, is it a chapbook?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and your chapbook is called The Perfect Guy, Poems by Reggie Cabico. And I think a lot of it has to do with you're able to write gay male sexuality. And in some ways, that's something that, first of all, how are you going to get that in mainstream media? You're
gay
not.
Gay male Filipino.
Oh, and specifically, yeah. Yes. And like, so it's very, you are mapping that and you're putting that marker. This is what it is for me, triangulating it as this specific mm-hmm. identity that I have.
Yeah.
And is it something that is it something that's just natural to you? You have to be authentic, so that's where it comes from.
I have to write about race and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of the years of being Catholic and suppressing that, I'm making up for those lost decades. I think I've made up for it now, but
you made up for it before too.
But I also, as I say, like the last 10 years, I've been writing very explicit, erotic, sexual, graphic
mm-hmm.
material of dating and sometimes loneliness and all of that stuff. And so this is why I'm sort of trying to open my world and just, I'm so conscious to the idea of erasure.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm not the only one doing it, but the erasure that I've experienced and what I see in my world, it's, I'm really hoping that I can probably, that'll be my next work, is to be able to, not so much about me, but what I see in the world, which is still about me, but, you know, mm-hmm. it's sort of turning that lens and also just survival too. Everything, being a poet, that there's nothing that is logical about it. And so to be, everything says stop, quit, don't do it. Everyone says don't do it. They're not going to get you. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to like this. This isn't really good. Like you have nothing to say. Someone could say it better than you. But
Or have you heard like, oh, it's already been done?
It's already been done.
Of all things. You're like, which Filipino gay poet has done this before?
It's always going to be done, but so is racism. Mm-hmm. Racism is never going to end. I hate to say this.
Mm-hmm.
It will like a bacteria or a virus mutate. Mm-hmm. So that's all. As long as that exists, then the art needs to exist, and it's going to keep being done, because that's the only, I say it in a poem, and poetry can hold us up. So the idea that, like, essentially, I think Joy Harjo said that all poems are love poems. Mm. And when you have a society that understands poetry and writes poetry, you're going to get a world full of empathy and humility and courage and listeners and people who can listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That was Filipino-American slam poet Reggie Cabico talking with Pamela Santos. You've been listening to Stage and Studio on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Alan Montecilio. You were listening to interviews from Pacific Underground, the Asian and Pacific Islander show here on KBOO. We decided to air parts of it on Stage and Studio this week. If you liked what you heard, tune in again next week to Stage and Studio, and tune in to Pacific Underground this Friday at 11 a.m. This month, we'll be talking about being mixed race, being part Asian, and what that means today. That's it for Stage and Studio this week. Thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. Our music this week was by Chops and Stage and Blue Dot Sessions. You can find and listen to this show at kboo.fm/stageandstudio. Like us on facebook.com/stageandstudio or tweet at stageandstudio. DMA Roberts will be back next week. I'm Ellen Montesilio. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors' Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck. Again, that's the Debtors' Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Who is Charles Koch? Who are the members of The Network, a semi-secret group assembled by the Koch brothers?
A lot of our donors don't want to take the kind of abuse that I do. They don't want these attacks. They don't want the death threats. So they aren't going to participate if they have to have their names associated with it.
How are the super rich's priorities transforming American society? Journalist Jane Mayer spent several years searching for some of those answers. Her new book is titled Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right.
So they basically looked at all the widgets of American policy and politics and started to create a machine that would suit their purposes.
This week on Making Contact, Jane Mayer is interviewed by Atlantic Magazine editor-in-chief James Bennett.